welcome to episode 12 of Tales from the Bridge. So, Kevin, Marty, and myself had a great conversation with Carl Schrader. We had the opportunity to talk about a lot of interesting things from his books to futurism and blockchain. We really hope you enjoy this conversation. We had a lot of fun. So here we go. Let's make our way over to the bridge.
I'll introduce Carl Schrader, our guest today. He's a science fiction author and futurist. He's written well over 10 books, I can see now. How many books have you written, Carl?
Something like a dozen, if you include The Million and the pieces that I did for the Canadian military.
Okay.
Yeah, which we can talk about.
This is The Crisis in Zephra. Directorate of Land Strategic Concepts. So this is part of your work as a futurist, I imagine.
That's
yes,
right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So some of the books that Carl has written are the Virga series, which is a series of five books that starts with Son of Suns. Kevin and I read Lockstep in the last few weeks, and I read Permanence as well. And his latest book is called Stealing Worlds, which Tristan has read and we'll be talking about. And that's based on it's I believe you said the first sci-fi thriller based on blockchain technology. So that's definitely something we want to talk about. Nice. So welcome to the show, Carl. Tristan, what do you have? You want to start us off here a little bit?
Well, Carl, I've got six quick questions for you, and I'm wondering if you could just give me the first answer that comes to your head when I ask you these, and then we can kind of swing back and talk about them.
Is this free association? Will there be a psychological profile of me?
Yes.
Definitely. Yes. We'll be holding up Rorschach blots as well.
and I use the word favorite, and I know it's very hard to find a favorite in anything, but if you could just do your best to give me something that really stands out. So what is your favorite science fiction book?
Yeah, it's funny because favorite doesn't necessarily mean I would reread something. There's books I've read that have had a profound effect on me, either as a writer or as a person, that I would never go back to. I loved watching Schindler's List, but I'm never going to watch it again. Right?
That's a great
example. There's books like that, and then there's books that I just go back and reread over and over again because they're fun, right? I grew up on Andre Norton's little space operas, and she wrote like 100 of them. They're my sick day reading, right? If I've got the flu or something and I'm holed up in the corner, I'll grab like the Zero Stone or something like that I read when I was 14, and I'll cheerfully, you know, immerse myself into it. I've been reading the Murderbot series lately in exactly that way, just having a ball with them. But in terms of a single science fiction work that had a profound effect on me, it would probably be Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand by Samuel Delaney.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's not a very well-known book, and it's a difficult book in a lot of ways because, Delaney's prose is very prolix and complex and stuff. But as a one-book education in everything that science fiction could be, I don't think you can do better than that one. Just the first section, the introduction of the main character, which is about 20 pages long, is a tour de force of technique, of scene setting, of character building. And then he subverts all the tropes of ordinary science fiction, within the last couple of pages of it. It's amazing, right?
Great.
But that's me, right? That's the sort of thing that gets me excited. And it's not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. So
Okay, good.
Well, we are interested in you. So that's perfect.
So I'm going to change the word from favorite to outstanding and just ask you the same question, but ask what to you do you think is a very outstanding science fiction movie? What's one that you would revisit?
Oddly enough, I rewatched Contact a couple months ago with Jodie Foster. And I don't know. I love that movie because it builds very, very slowly to a really strong sort of emotional connection with not just the main character, but sort of the deeper philosophical ideas. And that's really rare that you get something like that that works so effectively. Now, I also love Gravity. I love the soundtrack, and I love playing the climactic music where everything's coming apart and she's falling through the atmosphere as I'm taking off on trips in the plane, right? As we're taxiing down the runway, going, I just put that on and go, whoa! So I have a good experience of liftoff. Yeah, and the other one is, I'm blanking on the title, the recent First Contact movie with Amphipods.
Arrival, yeah.
Was it Arrival? Okay.
That's Denis Villeneuve film.
Yeah. Which is based on a short story.
That's right, by Ted Chiang.
That's right, yeah. Which is one of the best examinations of the implications of, you know, modern physics that I've ever seen, because it's purely emotional what those implications are, but really, really hard to get at by thinking through them, right? So you take physics and you say, well, this is what it means. And you go, well, okay. But he shows us what it means on a deep, visceral level. As a way of connecting ideas and our personal emotional lives, it's incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm. Both as a movie and as a short story, I mean, or a novella. I mean, I think that's one of the best pieces of fiction I've ever read, exactly for that reason, that he weaves this complicated, difficult to understand, you know, time symmetric physics stuff in with this emotional story about this daughter. And yeah, I love that story.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of thing that really excites me.
Cool.
And then this one I've got for you here. Can you tell me an outstanding classic sci-fi author? And then who would you say is an outstanding contemporary author? Someone that's new and really just writing some amazing stuff in the last couple of years. Oh.
Well, again, this is, of course, filtering through the perspective of a writer as opposed to a reader. And so you always have to bear in mind that what excites me is not necessarily what's going to excite you. I love Stanislaw Lem.
Ah.
The Polish.
My countryman, yes.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And I remember an awkward lunch I had with, I think it was Greg Bear and David Hartwell and Kim Stanley Robinson and a couple of other authors, where we were sitting around and talking about influences. And they were all Americans, and they were all talking about Heinlein and how much Heinlein had affected them and influenced them in their careers. And I sort of put my hand up and said, I'm sorry, I could never get through any of his books.
Yeah.
I just did not connect with Heinlein, but I connected with Lem. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because I'm, you know, one of these Canadian socialist pinkos in the Arctic. But I love Lem. I love The Invincible, which is a book almost nobody knows about, where basically in about 1955, he invents nanotechnology and then runs through all the implications of machine evolution in this little adventure story. It's wonderful stuff. In terms of contemporary authors, I'm not going to name anybody who's I think is like the best, because I don't think that's a good idea. There's a you know, bunches of people I like. You get Ted Chiang, obviously. Elizabeth Baer is a lot of fun. I'm reading her her space operas right now. Toby Bacall.
Cool.
There's just a whole generation of really good young writers out there. I would encourage anybody to just explore.
Yeah.
Very great. And then I've just got one more for you, Carl. And this is probably the most important question. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Neither.
Whoa.
I've never been a fan of either of those franchises.
Oh, wow. Great.
Sorry. Even as a kid. Well, and it's partly because my particular dedication is to the possibility of things. In other words, I think the most amazing stuff is stuff that could happen. Mm-hmm. So I consider Star Wars and Star Trek to be fantasies. Mm-hmm. They don't really explore any of the ideas that are relevant to us right now. I thought Star Trek The Next Generation was a great show about office culture. it's this idealized office where it's a perfect meritocracy and everybody gets a chance to contribute and then get rewarded at the end of the workday, right? And where the chairs are comfortable. So as science fiction, that's not so much for me.
Great. Well, before we leave that topic, actually, of influences and things, I did want to ask you if you're a fan of Orson Scott Card. Is that one of your influences?
No, not really.
No. Okay.
I've read some of Card's work, but I think that he and I have fundamental philosophical differences.
Ah, well, that's always very interesting. Okay. I just, in reading Lockstep, I mean, Lockstep is very, I don't know if you've read the Worthing Chronicle or the Worthing Saga. This goes back to some of Card's earliest work. I think it's his short story, Hot Sleep. It's a sort of similar idea of, you know, climbing the social ladder by staying asleep longer and becoming older, but without the lockstep part, right? That's the new ingredient in your book that makes it pretty fascinating as a way of overcoming, the time lag from traveling. But also, you know, the older sibling here is named Peter, as in the Ender, and there's two siblings, a sister and two brothers, right? And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And your moral sort of resolution to the guy who gets punished, Coley, I think it is, right? He has to tell people the story of what he did. That's sort of, I noticed that was in Red Prophet too. That's sort of the resolution to Orson Scott Card. So I thought, oh wow, is this a tribute to Card's work? But I guess there's a lot of common ideas everywhere. So
yeah, but it's interesting you raise Lockstep after Star Wars and Star Trek, because Lockstep is in a lot of ways an answer to
right
Star Wars and Star Trek. It's a book that says we can have this kind of adventure story in the universe that we actually live in.
Right.
It was a little sort of challenge I set to myself. Mm-hmm.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4/6 Success Filmmaking. 4/6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4/6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Maybe for our listeners, we can just fill in a few details here. So Lockstep is the premise is that hibernation technology is easily available, you know, and but everybody in the entire sort of interplanetary civilization goes to sleep for the same amount of time on the same cycle. So you can sleep for 30 years or 30 months and then be awake for a month and then go to sleep for 36 months or whatever it is. And that way people get to travel between all the planets while everybody's asleep. And so you can hop on a plane and go overnight. And when everybody wakes up, or on a spaceship, you're at the next thing. And this sort of, you know, locking of the hibernation cycle allows people to overcome the time lag of everything. I have one question about that for you while we're talking about it.
Sure.
As a physicist, you know, I've been trying to work through the consequences of this, but simultaneity is not a thing that exists as I understand it, right? From general relativity, there is no now moment that you can talk about for the entire or a large, you know, space time sort of volume. So how does that play into lockstep? Is it, I think possibly that everybody has to travel at the same speed and then everybody experiences the same amount of time dilation as well. Is that a necessary ingredient here?
Well, basically, there's a lot of flex and slop to it. It imitates simultaneity without actually anything being simultaneous, right?
Oh, interesting.
So you are going to get cases where people, wake and find out somehow that they've skipped a month, or they're waking, off schedule. Just because you're right. I mean, relativity doesn't give us a universal clock. So there is no universal clock for the lockstep civilization, but they pretend there is.
Right, right.
And they can get close to it by pretending really well or pretending really hard.
Yeah.
And you could calculate those subjective times too, right? So the computer that's waking people up, or the little, you know, cat creatures that are waking people up, could potentially adjust that to ensure that subjective time. They wake up either late or a little bit early to synchronize with where they're landing.
Yeah, they try and do that, and insofar as they can, but it's not a perfect system. It is a simulation of faster than light civilization, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as far as I know, the only way that you could have one, other than slow time, but that's a whole other approach.
Neat. Well, there's one other thing we wanted to talk about in lockstep, and I think this will get us talking about another set of topics we're really interested in with you. There's a great part in lockstep where there's this political negotiation, and everybody's wearing these what do we call it, AR, augmented reality type glasses, you know, throughout this whole book that labels things for them and, you know, the things you would imagine. But one of the interesting things that you do in lockstep, and then a lot more of in your story, Degrees of Freedom, in this collection, Hieroglyph, is sort of an app that makes political negotiation more effective. And the simplest one is, I think, in lockstep. And I'd love for you to tell us about more of the ones that you have in Degrees of Freedom. But in lockstep, there's simply a color overlay for people's faces. And there, you know, AI or your AI app is sort of reading their faces, their expressions, this sort of automated thing. And so when you're giving a speech to a bunch of people, your overlay colors them green or red or black, depending on their reaction. So you can tell how much of the audience you have with you, you know, in terms of agreeing or being favorable or scowling and not agreeing or just not computing the notions that you're getting across at all. So I love that. I mean, it's just so simple, but it would really make a huge difference, you know, in so many respects, education and giving lectures to people or political speeches, all of these things. So we find that really interesting, these sort of social science fiction notions that you bring into your work. Why don't you just talk about that a little bit more and tell us, you know, where these ideas are coming from, where you think they're going? I would love to hear what you think already exists that could become more like that kind of tool in the future.
Yeah, I mean, my first several books were set a minimum of 500 years in the future. Mm-hmm. I was writing, you know, way out there stuff. While I was doing that, I was writing a bunch of short stories about a pathologically shy Ukrainian arms inspector named Gennady Malyanov, who loves being sent to places like Chernobyl because he knows that there's not going to be anyone else there that he has to talk to. And
this is the Lem influence, isn't it?
To some degree, yeah. He's Gennady Malyanov is the anti-James Bond. He is in all ways exactly as uncharismatic as Bond is charismatic. He's the janitor of the nuclear age. I found that those stories were fun to write, and they also scratched an itch. They let me talk about contemporary issues in a much more direct way than the far future stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I've become more and more interested in doing that, and more engaged with issues like global warming and the future of governance that I think are critical for us. And having a daughter in 2003 had an immense impact on me in terms of my sense of responsibility and what I needed to do to express in my writing. So that's where stories like Degrees of Freedom come from. Mm-hmm. And I think that democracy is aided by technology. It can be, right? You can look at history as the record of progressive improvements in information technology and how we use it to coordinate ourselves. And in that case, we are at a very primitive level with computers right now, where we invented them and we started using them to do stuff we already do, like Marshall McLuhan says we always do with technologies. We put spreadsheets on them, right? We knew what spreadsheets were, so we put them on them. We put forms on them. We put the things that are already existed in our bureaucracies into computerized form. But that's not the same as using computers in the ways that only they can be used. And now, just in the last decade, we're starting to see ways that computers can directly be used to improve decision-making, democracy, finance, and so forth. And a lot of this is happening in the blockchain area, but that's, you know, something of a red herring. There's a whole suite of technologies in there. But there's things like token curated registries, which are basically just a kind of list. But they're a way of making trustworthy lists without having a central authority. That's an incredibly powerful tool for democracy. And it's one of many different sorts of things I'm trying to put together right now into a comprehensive vision of the future of society. Because if I'm going to write stories that are set like 20, 30 years in the future, this stuff is going to be there, and I need to understand it. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit more about that in your discussions of blockchain? I mean, it's important enough that you made it an important theme of Stealing Worlds, right? So you're taking this concept of a trustless environment and decentralized distributed ledgers and trying to apply it to science fiction. So maybe putting on both of your futurist and science fiction author hat, can you talk about why you decided to use blockchain as a theme in your latest book?
Sure. You know, if you play video games, particularly adventure games or shooters, you have a tendency to pick up items as you go along, and you put the items into your inventory. So you get an ever-growing inventory of stuff. And if you're playing The Breath of the Wild or something like that, you're going to end up with weird stuff in your inventory, like couches, 50 or 60 different swords, jewels and all kinds of stuff. And we're asked to believe that you have some kind of bag of holding that you can carry all that stuff around in. What blockchain technology does is it gives virtual things like the stuff in your inventory some of the characteristics of real physical things, such as persistence, uniqueness, robustness. They're hard to destroy. There's only one of them. They can be traded back and forth. This is what makes a Bitcoin a Bitcoin, the fact that there's only one of this particular coin, but you can trade it back and forth. This is something that didn't exist with virtual digital items before. So once you have that capability, all of a sudden, it's you don't just have the ability to do Bitcoin and currencies. You can also apply this this kind of virtual soul, if you will, to anything else, including, say, stuff in your inventory. So you can change what ownership means. You can change what property is using this kind of technology. And this is basically a change to something that we have not changed in, 20,000 years? It's a brand new capability where you can have partial ownership of things. You can have distributed ownership. You can have what are called rights bundles for things. And all of this has a profound, or will have a profound impact on the way that we buy and sell and own. It's kind of necessary to talk about. But it's also fun because you can have a story where your characters have a literal inventory and they have the rights to all kinds of virtual things that can be instantiated as real things. So at one point in Stealing Worlds, Compass has gained the right to a suite of rooms. It's in her inventory, right? Mm-hmm. But she can instantiate that. She can visit a city and say, okay, are there some free rooms here? Fine, I'm going to instantiate my rooms there. So I live there for now. You can have that kind of arrangement, which has never been really possible before. You can have leasing and selling and renting and things like that. But this is different. Mm-hmm. This is new, right? And it's a lot of fun to talk about and speculate about.
So it's almost like you're taking what many of us in the virtual world will understand fairly intuitively, like you said, your virtual inventory, and putting some really smart ways of controlling that intellectual property. But what you're saying is there's also that same mechanism could be used in the real world, right? So what we might talk of as NFTs or non-fungible tokens or what have you, exploring what the world would look like if we really embraced this as a technology. Is that right?
Yes, because NFTs are an example of this new ability to associate a persistent virtual object, persistent unique virtual object, with a real-world physical object. And at one point in Stealing Worlds, one of the characters picks up a crumpled Coke can and just, scans it quickly with their phone camera and says, okay, now I'm going to put, 20 Bitcoin or Notch coin, which is
Notch coin,
the virtual currency or the digital currency that we're using. I'm going to put 20 of these things in this can. Now, if you scan this can, if you own this can, and scan this can again, you can get $20 essentially out of it. And then he says, okay, right. Tosses the can in a dumpster and somebody goes, wait, what? And runs after it, right? Because all of a sudden that can has value. So you can do that kind of thing in a way that you never could before. You can have a treasure, which is somebody has put into their old ratty fountain pen in exactly this way. And you can have somebody looking for the inheritance, which grandpa has squirreled away somewhere in the mansion. But he's done so in a virtual NFT sort of way. And it turns out to be in this pen on the desk. But you've got to go around and scan everything to find it, figure out grandpa's clues that are left behind, right? You can have all kinds of cool stories.
That's a great use case for this, because you hear about people who lose fortunes of blockchain because they've lost their, you know, 128-character password to gain access to it. But if you could, like you say, have a 2D barcode stuck somewhere and it's a physical hidden access to that NFT or to that whatever that that piece of property is, that's a great idea to explore.
Yeah, and it's also examining this blurred line between the virtual and the physical, which is also fun.
I agree. And is that do you I mean, this is science fiction, but in the real world, do you kind of align most with the Ethereum network, or is that kind of where you think this could live?
Well, I know some of the founders of Ethereum, and I'm kind of loyal to it. Yeah. Ethereum is specifically for the construction of smart contracts, which is how you would administer this kind of thing. So, for instance, if you want to divide your inheritance among your heirs, you can have a multi-sig contract assigned to that pen, where it requires all five of your squabbling children to put their signature on to do a transaction with the money that you have squirreled away in your fountain pen. So Ethereum is a tool for doing that. Now, there are others that are being developed now. So there's rivals to Ethereum, but that's a good thing. That's a sign that there's a good idea there and that it's worth pursuing.
I have to flex a little bit here. I am wearing my Ethereum Waterloo hackathon shirt from I volunteered at the hackathon a few years ago. Nice. And greeted Vitalik at the door. He was he's such an interesting guy.
Oh yeah.
He's and I mean, how ahead of his time is he for a young man to do what he's done? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and he's working on other things aside from Ethereum. The radical liberalism, or is it liberal radicalism? I forget which. There's a wonderful paper up on archive about it, and it's basically a solution to funding public goods without, again, having to go through a central authority. Immense implications to that if it can be done. And I wrote a story about those ideas. The title will come to me in a moment.
Is it Tehai from Far Selenia? That's certainly one of your older ones, but it has a lot of that in it.
I'm very fond of Tehai from Far Selenia, not just because of the title.
It's a great name.
It really sets up everything. It tees up everything that I subsequently did with Stealing Worlds. Right. And most of these ideas can be found in that one story.
And this is one of these Gennady Malyanov stories, yes?
Yes, it is. There's another one called Deodand, which tees up the rest of the ideas in in Stealing Worlds. The idea that you could associate an NFT or a digital object with a natural system, such as a forest or a river, and then attach an artificial intelligence to that is self-interested. And in other words, wants to work for the benefit of that forest or that river, etc. I'm doing some real world work right now about trying to actually create such things, which would be cool if it works.
That's well, actually fascinating, because there's a not to get too nerdy here, but there's a branch of organizational theory called stakeholder theory that assumes that if you're going to think about a problem in the markets or in value creation for anyone, you have to consider who are all the stakeholders. And it tends to anthropomorphize that, where they say it needs to be a human stakeholder. Right. But there's a lot of people who say, well, actually, there are other ways for advocacy to occur for something, let's say a forest or let's say an ecosystem. I have never heard about an AI being an advocate for, a forest or something. But what an amazing idea. This is something that could actually be used in a lot of existing business theory.
You can associate, think of it just in primitive terms by as adding a set of smart contracts. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a forest which is surrounded by a fence that has a gate in it, and there's a smart lock on the gate. You can attach a deodand to the forest that gets paid every time you put a coin in the smart lock or use your phone app to buy access to the walking trails. And it takes that money and plows it back into forest management. Mm-hmm. So there, very straightforward, simple deodand. But they can get much, much more complex using AI or using collective intelligence, where you use human beings as your processors. Working on that. Also very interested in the future of politics and trying to figure out how to write a cool book about that, but I'm not quite there yet on that one. Rockets are easy, people are hard.
Yeah. Well, I would love for you to, since we're talking about politics and tools for politics, your story in the Hieroglyph collection was about resolving the First Nations, issues in Canada specifically, right? And of like, you know, having tools that really bring stakeholders and the relevant people to the table to be able to negotiate properly to finally resolve this you know, huge overhanging issue in our country, especially these days. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. Why did you write that? Are you hopeful? Are you participating in that as a futurist somehow in that particular issue?
Well, first of all, I'm interested in the issue. Secondly, I'm interested in, I never really thought about it in this way, but in the way that you phrased the question, I guess what interests me is in finding ways of leveling the playing field. Mm. Because when you do have stakeholders and a broad range of stakeholders, there is always some unevenness of power involved. But there's also an unevenness of how much stake the stakeholders have. You can often have a situation where someone with very little stake in the situation has a great deal of power over the situation, and those who have the greatest stake have little or no power. Mm-hmm. And that is the historical situation that we're trying to get out of, and probably sort of boiled down to its most abstract, right? How do you create tools going forward that can balance that? So there is, for instance, a guy named John Richardson on the West Coast who has a company called Ethelo, E-T-H-E-L-O. And he uses a particular algorithm to bring together groups of stakeholders to make decisions, where the algorithm can bump up the impact of certain stakeholders and sort of balance that with the more powerful voices to ensure that everybody gets heard and everybody gets a say. Mm-hmm. The reason that I was interested in First Nations democratic circles was the idea of meetings, and you know, the Icelandic moot sort of worked the same way, I believe, where everybody sits down in a circle and then everyone tells their story, one after another, with no time limit, right? So that everybody gets a chance to do a full airing in a state of absolute equality. We don't actually have that in our democracy right now. But there are people, and again, Vitalik Buterin has talked about a process called liquid democracy, which has some of these characteristics, and he's an advocate for. I'm interested in building this kind of tool, but I'm also interested in this tool only if it's perfectly usable for, say, a unilingual female Chinese immigrant in her 70s who's raised a big family, never watched the news, but nonetheless, because of being here, raising that family, is as much of a citizen and stakeholder in the country as anybody else, and therefore has as much right to be heard as anyone else. Any tool that we come up with has to be as usable and as accessible for her as it is for guys in Ottawa, business people, tech heads like ourselves, right? So there's a challenge here, but only part of that challenge is this wonderful new technology. The biggest part of the challenge is the UX part, getting it into people's hands and getting them to use it.
Wow.
There's if you are interested, I'm just pasting in a really interesting article. It's a seminal work around kind of categorizing salience of stakeholders in it's actually in a business context, but it could be used in a poli-sci context or anywhere. And it's actually might be informative. It's in the chat if you're interested.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, obviously it's easy for me to nerd out about ideas like this, but when I write, I do try and make sure that my characters are suitably terrified and there are explosions.
So would you consider yourself a part of the, I guess one way to put this is it Bitcoin or is it blockchain? Because there's an argument there. There's two sides there seems to be when it comes to the value of the technology or just the, and it often comes down to just libertarians and their Bitcoin only. Where are you in there? Are you into the tech or do you feel like you're a part of the crypto community?
I've been adopted to some degree by the crypto community, but I'm not a fan of Bitcoin. I'm not particularly interested in currency, although I have invented, a notional one called Guaycoin, which is a self-redistributing currency. If you have too many Guaycoin in your wallet, the extra ones start getting restless and looking around for other people's empty wallets that they might have.
Well, that would just piss libertarians off. So.
It's the anti-libertarian coin. Yeah,
I am not a libertarian. there's a lot of problems with Bitcoin. But blockchain and related technologies, I am very, very interested in.
So do you see a lot of use case with AI? Because I've followed a little bit of Ben Goertzel, who's been working on AI since the 90s, I believe. And he has been working on AI for over 30 years. He's an author as well of some fiction and nonfiction. And he said that it was before, when the smart contract came out, that he realized decentralizing AI is that's how we avoid the Skynet scenario. And that's a good use case. Do you see use case with AI? Is it better to decentralize AI so that all the information is not, it's not just Google that has the information or Facebook, and that it's decentralized so that everyone can input information and bad actors will simply be screened out by all the good actors?
I am very much a fan of that idea. And in my recent work, there's a story that you can read for free online called The Suicide of Our Troubles. And it and Stealing Worlds introduced the idea of self-administering common pool resources. And at the limit, these are things like each of your tools and even the boards in the backyard that you're going to build something with. Each has a little virtual AI mind associated with it in the way that we've talked about as a sort of NFT that advocates for it, for the, its best use. So for instance, you could say, if you're a capitalist, then you believe that the capitalists control the means of production. If you're a communist, you believe the workers should control the means of production. In my world, the means of production own themselves. But not in the Skynet or Matrix sort of way. The individual bricks on themselves, right? Everything in the built and unbuilt environment for in my stories right now is in a kind of dream time, dreaming what it could be used to build, and asking people, human beings, for what they want, and dreaming and coordinating and saying, hey, actually, we could do this, right? I talked to this 50,000 brick pile over here, and they're not getting used for anything else, right? And there's these pipes over here, and there's a bunch of workers who are not doing anything right now. They're just sitting around. Let's invent a temporary currency to pay them. And invent an organization and build a hospital, right? This is a sort of completely different vision of how AI could work. And once they're all built, the bricks all go to sleep, right? they're satisfied. They've done their thing. It's again, we inherited this idea of central command and control from bureaucracy, from older technologies, and we're just starting to come to terms with what the new technologies can do. As McLuhan said, we use the new technology to do what we did with the old one for a while until we suddenly realize that there's something new we can do. And with computers, we are right at that point right now. So in that sense, the visions of the future of AI and stuff like that in science fiction right up until today are pretty much obsolete. We've got to start from scratch and start over again to really come to terms with how that they're going to affect our lives and what we're going to do with them.
If we start from scratch and we go to that idea that you're describing, which is fascinating, this idea that, you know, the bricks could be imbued with their own sense of purpose and desire and motivation, right? Because you're transacting with them to build your hospital in some way. I see a centralization problem in that whoever builds that purpose into them suddenly has control, right? So once again, you've decentralized a system and the centralization comes into the programming of them or the creation of that sense of purpose.
Yeah.
That's a tricky one.
Yeah, it is. But it's all about, at that point, society and the kind of society that you want to have. How much control groups within society will have as opposed to individuals, right? I have this idea. I don't really have a good name for it right now, but I'm calling it an adornment principle right now. Instead of the model of colonialism, where we're bursting out into the cosmos and colonizing planets and this sort of thing, I think of humanity as the antlers of the earth, or say the plumage of the earth. We are the unnecessary but awesome thing that evolution has thrown up on the planet. We are the gaudy plumage of this world. We don't have to exist, but we are an expression of the over overwhelming abundance of health and fertility that this planet has. And we have an opportunity to preen, basically. So when I see Elon Musk building his rockets and talking about going to Mars, I don't think of that in terms of having a backup planet or colonizing the universe. I think, yeah, give him the money, let him do that, because he's the really great set of antlers, right?
Or plumage, as you say. That's a great metaphor, actually. Yeah. Because, you know, feathers are the classic sort of example in evolution of something that evolved for one purpose and got taken up by an unexpected purpose. So, you know, we evolved these feathers to stay warm and survive, but now we find we can actually fly on them, right? Yeah. And Elon Musk can fly on them out to Mars.
Right. So I don't want a gray socialist future where all wealth is perfectly evenly distributed and nobody has enough money to do something awesome. I want a gaudy future where everybody, you know, wealth is distributed, but we also allow groups to enlist the help of these resources we were talking about to create crazy projects, to pull in like-minded people. So to have politics that allows projects, right? Again, people are working on this kind of thing. What I mentioned earlier, the token curated lists, are an example, and Vitalik's radical liberalist, or what's it called again? Anyway, his approach to funding public goods. There are ways to get all the stakeholders involved and get the quiet voices heard. While not leveling everything out so that nothing can get done. And that's what's really exciting. We could have a future where the spectacular projects of capitalism can still happen in a context where the centralization and you know, the 1% problem doesn't exist. Without centralized planning, right? That's what makes it cool. So I want to write about that. I've got a bunch of adventures set on Venus that I'm working on right now.
Oh, neat. Well, we do like to read. Oh, I'm echoing. We do like to read some of the work by the authors we talked to. And since you mentioned it, this latest story of yours, The Suicide of Our Troubles, I found it here. It's on slate.com. Yeah. And it's I thought I'd maybe just read the first two paragraphs for people to get a sense of your style and the kinds of things you talk about. So this is The Suicide of Our Troubles. And then the byline in slate.com here is, in a new short story, pollution tries to remove itself from the environment, by Carl Schrader. So, Nadine Bach noticed a package of ham waving at her from inside the grocery store. November was one of those months when the choice was between paying rent and buying food, and she hadn't planned to stop by during her daily walk, but this ham was proclaiming that it was free. Having prospective meals wave at her was hardly unexpected. Mixed reality was finally maturing past the flying whale stage of visual grab-assery and was settling into the predictable role of being yet another advertising medium. She walked to the meat counter and frowned at the colorful avatar dancing above the ordinary package of ham. "What's the catch?" she said. "Are you a loss leader?" That's great.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm in. Let's go. Yeah.
I can't help but be thinking about the cow at the restaurant at the end of the universe trying to convince Arthur Dent and them to eat
it. Yeah, that did kind of come to mind. And it would be creepy if you associated an AI with an animal that tried to auction it off. So there's definitely dark dystopian versions of this that you could write. But I'm not going to, because you know, I do... have kind of a commitment to optimism.
Yeah, awesome. I figured that. So actually, that's a great transition. If you don't mind, about optimism versus pessimism. So we talked to Peter Watts, who I believe is a friend of yours. You guys talk sometimes, yeah. And you know, and I found in an acknowledgement of one of his of Blindsight somewhere in his book Blindsight, he has this paragraph, and I want to read it out because that's the reason I read Permanence. So it says, thanks also to Carl Schrader, with whom I batted around a number of ideas in the arena of sentience versus intelligence. Parts of Blindsight can be thought of as a rejoinder to arguments presented in Carl's novel, Permanence. I disagree with his reasoning at almost every step, and am still trying to figure out how we arrived at the same general endpoint. And I think you guys couldn't be more different authors. I mean, from what I've read of your work, you're definitely the optimist, and he's definitely the pessimist. And yet you come to the same point, he says, and I would love for you to comment on that and maybe have a bit of a talk about permanence, because I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I thought it ended in the same general end point, but anyway, they couldn't be more different. So how do you compare permanence with Blindsight, or what do you have to say to Peter about that?
Well, I'm the carrot and Peter is the stick. But we do share a fundamental worldview. I think we both see the world. We both see the same world. Put it that way, and we're both very passionately committed to seeing the world as it is, which is why we are always following the science. Mm-hmm. And always following the possibility. Now, we differ a lot in our approach to making people passionate about this, right? But that's a personality thing,
right?
We both think want the same sort of world in the end. But as I say, he's the stick, I'm the carrot. And that's a perfectly sort of valid way to go. It's the same with me and Cory Doctorow, right?
Ah.
We're in fundamental agreement about pretty well everything, but we are focused on very different areas. He's always had a focus on digital rights, and I let him have that. I'm not going anywhere near that, right? Because he is so good at it. I just wouldn't presume. But we both see the same issues. And so when I'm talking about, an animated piece of ham in my story, I'm again, working in the same realm. So we're all three of us sort of engaged in different parts of what you might call the same program, although I couldn't tell you what that program is.
I feel like Cory Doctorow is arguing for the same thing in our current paradigm of technologies. You know, when he's talking about digital rights, he's talking about it using what we know and what we do. You're at the next step where we see these emerging technologies using distributed ledgers, blockchains, and this idea of integrating AI with it, which is fascinating, and where we could go with it. And that could circumvent some digital rights issues, right? And then Peter, he's going kind of to the next step, dystopian, where we could go wrong. And that's a really interesting way to compare the three of you guys, actually. I'm glad you brought up Cory. He's going to be coming on the show, I think, next month, actually.
Yeah. If you're doing strategic foresight, that is looking into the future for clients, whether that be government or commercial, you do want to see the positives and the negatives, because you want a clear-eyed view of what's possible. So you don't go into it just as a Pollyanna, and I don't either. What interests me, and therefore what I'm good at, because I expend my energy on it, is finding the terrifying problems and then saying, okay, we could warn people, or we could present a possible solution, with the warning being implicit. right? And that's sort of more my my interest or my approach. So when I was writing Stealing Worlds, I described it as a pre-apocalyptic novel. It's written in that liminal moment where things could go either way, right? You were either careening into disaster or we are about to institute a utopia. And we don't know which, right? The characters in that book just have to, you know, put their heads down and go for it and see what happens.
Well, something that you just said there kind of reminds me of the character Harry Seldon in the Foundation series. Are you familiar with Harry Seldon?
Yeah.
Was he an inspiration, or was that character or Ozma's work an inspiration? Because it kind of sounds like that's something strategic foresight is related to what the psychohistorians were doing.
Oh, well, we could have a whole conversation about psychohistory and its impact or influences on foresight. And I gave a presentation a couple of years back on models of change, how people think that things change and therefore how they think we get to the future, right? One of those that was very popular back in the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s was this managerial concept of if we were like Laplace's demon and we had perfect knowledge of how the world worked, we could project all the changes forward and just manage our way to the utopia that we want, right? It's a very deterministic. But now, of course, we're in the quantum era where everything is random. our current model of change as a society is not the one in Foundation, which is what is going to make it interesting to watch that series to see how they do that. Because I think there's a general understanding right now that there are things like critical states and sand piles, cascades, changes like the instantaneous collapse in the 2008 financial crisis that are not intrinsically are unpredictable, and therefore you can't manage in the way that Harry Seldon does. But what I want to do is just present possible futures, which again is one of those things that you do in foresight. You present scenarios. This could happen, or this could happen. And sometimes you have a visible path that you can walk towards one of those futures. So, for instance, for the 4-degree increase global warming catastrophe, we know what the path towards that is. It's business as usual, right? So you can say that. We don't quite know all the things that will lead to the opposite utopian future, but we know what some of them are, so we can present those, right? A lot of what I do. Mm-hmm.
So I have noticed that in your work is especially with a lot of these political kind of economic social apps that you kind of propose in your work, that they're simulation based, right? And there's a really great contrast to what we were just talking about. Harry Seldon did the deterministic calculation. The way to do probabilistic calculations is exactly that. You calculate the possibilities on top of each other, and then you weigh their probabilities. And so that is a different approach to predicting the future, like you're talking about, right? It's largely simulation based. If we have this scenario, if we move A, how does B change? If we move B, how does A change? And then you sort of simulate your way through the possibilities. And like you say, maybe there's a path through them that presents itself when you do things that way.
Right. And what you need for that is you need Peter Watts writing stories, you need Cory Doctorow writing stories, and you need me writing stories, right? You need a spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
So with that futurist hat on, when I'm thinking about that, like, how does one get into that as a career, and who are your customers? So, and I'm not thinking selfishly, I'm just wondering, what you're describing as a plot theme in science fiction is also very salient to someone. So scenario planning for the future, is that governments? Is that military? Like who would come and knock on your door and hire you as a futurist?
Governments, military, large corporations, public organizations, nonprofits, anybody who is interested in strategic planning as opposed to fighting fires, which is what most companies do most of the time. Mm-hmm. If you're purely reactive, you're not doing foresight and you're not really capable of doing foresight. And even most governments are purely reactive most of the time. But most militaries, for instance, are not. They do strategic planning. Now, how do you get into it? Well, until recently, it was something that people fell into by accident, having started out as something else. So anthropologists, engineers, business people, systems analysts, sociologists would suddenly find themselves in charge of a foresight activity for whoever they worked for and had to make up their capabilities, out of whole cloth. And then would look for like-minded consultants and say, well, how did you do this? And so it was all put together in this sort of networking fashion. Now, just in the last decade or so, you can actually go out and deliberately get a degree in it. And if you go to OCAD University in Toronto, you can get a master's in strategic foresight and innovation, which is new. There was a certificate available from Houston prior to that, but it was not a full degree. So I do have that degree. I was one of the first cohort to come out of that program. But I got my start by being hauled into foresight conferences in Ottawa by Jack Smith, who was at the National Science Council back in the early aughts. Basically, I got paraded around as the automatically wackiest person in the room.
We got ourselves a sci-fi author. Here he is.
And therefore, my very presence gave the quants and bureaucrats a little bit of permission to go outside of their comfort zone in speculating. Hmm. So I call that my dancing bear period, right? and from there, I was given more and more opportunities to do actual foresight analysis and work, and eventually got hired by the Canadian military to write two short novels, Crisis in Zephyra and Crisis in Aurelia. Those are their titles, not mine. But books that are very popular, I'm told, with the U.S. Marine Corps and other places around the world, which are deliberate foresight fiction.
Wow.
And so a bit different from science fiction. But from there, I haven't looked back. I'm now a research fellow at the Human Futures Studio, working with some really interesting anthropologists to create a new kind of futures consultancy.
And is game theory an important aspect to strategic foresight?
It used to be. And to some degree, it still is. Back in the 40s, it was incredibly important. Game theory is closely aligned to analytic philosophy, which is also what you can see lurking in the background of blockchain technology. And the people who are building that technology are implicitly or explicitly fans of analytic philosophy, which I am not. I take a very different approach to all of these things. But game theory is baked in at a basic level in, for instance, in blockchain.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And the idea of scenarios, which is related, is baked in to foresight on some pretty fundamental levels. But there are a lot of different methodologies in foresight, and that's just one of them.
So you're working on this, obviously, as part of what you do. Is there any other fiction that you're working on that you'd like to talk about or share with anyone?
Yeah, sure. I'm working on more stories in my million / lockstep universe. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, I'm doing some stuff on Venus. I have an Arctic airship novel that I want to write. And I'm working on a time travel story as well. So let's see. All of those things are actually all likely to drop at the same time because I'm working on them all simultaneously. Which is not my usual approach, but it's why you haven't seen anything from me for a little while. I sort of expect to turn on the fire hose and put out a whole bunch of stories at some point in the near future.
Will we get any more books in the Virga series?
If someone comes to me with a bag of money and drops it at my feet, then yes. Virga is a really good example of something I like to do, which is to create universes that can be taken up by other people. There's no reason why somebody else can't set stories in the kind of construct that I built for Virga stories. It's like the Ring World, right? Yeah. Once you have the idea of the Ring World, then you can create Halo, right? You can set all kinds of stories there, and I love doing that. Lockstep's the same, so I don't feel any great compulsion to add to the Virga universe myself. But I could, because I created it as an open-ended playground, basically. And same with Lockstep, right? Mm-hmm. It's for me the best way to build a story, to build a universe around it that's so much of a fun playground that you want to come back to it.
But Virga.
Is it easy to write? The Virga series, is it easier than some of the other works that have less science? I mean, you still have a lot of science in the Virga series, but it's more of a fun adventure. It borderlines a YA novel in some ways, and I think that's great because it's just the pages turn themselves. Is that easier or more difficult for you?
In a lot of ways, it's easier. Yeah, I've sort of decided to write in two modes. One, pure fun, and the other science fiction that would make Stanislaw Lem proud, right? And they don't have to be, they can both be in the same story. Ideally, they are, right? But one of my favorite Virga books was The Sunless Countries, which is the fourth book. Mm-hmm. I liked it because I had already set up everything. I had already done everything, right? So this was a book that just had to please itself. And so I could just focus on my history tutor, Lial, living in one of the sunless countries, listening to the foghorns ringing out over her city, and just having this basic steampunk gothic kind of adventure on her own. Once you've got the world and you've settled into it, you can have that kind of fun. I also am really happy with books like Stealing Worlds or Lady of Mazes that are deliberately intended to astonish. The pleasure in these books is supposed to come from just that feeling of being dragged from one wonder to the next, and that's huge fun to do as well.
Maybe I would. I do want to just give a little more detail for our listeners about Virga, because it is such an interesting world. The world you built there is sort of these balloon worlds, I guess. It's a graphene or some sort of very strong material that makes a sort of planet-sized balloon that's filled with an atmosphere, but no gravity. And I think that's just a wonderful world to play in, right? Because you get to be in space without all the bother of the suits and vacuums. And, like, you know, space stories tend to be dominated by all the difficulties of surviving in vacuum. And you get to just fly ships and, you know, be in this world, but everybody can breathe, thank God, right? So you don't have to, it makes it so much easier to just sort of have an interesting raw narrative with great ships and technologies, and everybody's flying, and different, you know, biological effects that this would have, lacking gravity and having gravity wheels and spinning centripetal things, but everybody gets to breathe, so it's just so much more natural. A story.
Yeah, I mean, one of my characters flies around on a home-built jet engine with a saddle and handlebars on it. And another is an itinerant gravity seller. She's got the same sort of rig, but what she does is she visits outlying farms that are like potato clouds, right? So she visits a potato cloud asks the farmer, hey, do you need some gravity today? I'll spin your house. Right, so it attaches a rope to the house and just puts the jet on full throttle and spins the damn house in a circle for a couple of hours so that the people living in it can have some weight. So why not? Yeah, if you've got a world like that, you want to do that kind of thing and have pirate adventures and that's exactly, you know, why I created Virga. Just to have that kind of fun.
So, Carl, what have we not talked about in your world that we should have been talking about?
Well, you did want me to talk about permanence. Permanence is one of those cases where I set myself a constraint. And this is something I played with both in it and Lockstep. How do you have a Star Wars or Star Trek type interstellar civilization when you don't have faster than light travel? Solving that problem makes you go down all these interesting cul-de-sacs that end up with some weird world building. And then you get that opportunity, right, to have your gravity cellars and so on. So I did this with permanence, and I ended up with a civilization scattered through brown dwarfs and nomad planets between the stars that are just close enough that you can connect to them with slow relativistic spacecraft. And I invented a system called the Cyclers that are spaceships which basically, once going, go in a perpetual cycle between worlds. And you can zip up to one and treat it as a cruise liner to take you to some next world, and then go down to that world while the ship goes on. But because I'm always bored with just one thing, I also decided to write about the Fermi paradox. Are we alone in the universe? What does that mean for us on a spiritual level? And a bunch of other stuff. So that was my second novel. I was still in the kitchen sink phase of my writing career.
Well, I love that aspect of it. I'm the hippie philosophical mystic in the crowd. So I love what you did with those spiritual and psychological religious overtones. In permanence, because you were addressing this sort of big question, and I hadn't seen it formulated quite this way, but it's true that if the Fermi paradox question, right, if are we alone, depends on the survivability of an advanced civilization, how long it can last, right? It may well be that there are these little flares of intelligence and sentience that might make it to the stars, but if we only last a couple hundred years or 1,000 years, nobody will ever get to meet anybody else. We'll never meet any aliens, and so I think you formulated that question really well as, you know, the question of permanence. Can a single intelligent interstellar species survive for long, like geologically long types of time. And what you, I think your insight is really interesting, that that means those time spans are biological time spans too. So you inevitably as a species will evolve, and your evolution could even get away from you or become, you know, your competitors might branch off of the species in the future to ultimately stop the project. So, and I think the moral core that you come to there is really beautiful, right? That the message is no single species can survive, just like no single individual can survive and be immortal. But what can survive is a niche, the ecological niche, if we could call it that, of an intelligent starfaring species. And so maybe these advanced civilizations, you know, they put their efforts into nurturing that niche for other intelligent alien type species, rather than trying to defend themselves against change or defend themselves against extinction. And I think you point out to this, that, you know, even the deeper level here is it's a great spiritual lesson for people too, right? That your individual immortality is not possible, but what is possible is having children, right? We pass on the function, the niche that our lives serve by giving it on to the next member. So I think that's amazing and very different from Blindsight. I don't think Peter Watts has that message.
No, but he again comes to the same conclusions about consciousness and intelligence, because impermanence, I do have as a central point that intelligence is only necessary when you have a reason to use it. Once you have fully developed your technological civilization and you've had it for a million years, you don't need to think anymore on a straightforward biological level, because everything is provided. It's you know, fully automated luxury communism at that point. At that point, there is no reason why genetic drift will just take you away from being intelligent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not inevitable that we stay intelligent and conscious once we have conquered the universe or whatever it is we're going to do. But yeah, these ideas actually end up relating to you know, my current thoughts on the role of AI, you know, in helping us develop further, and in, you know, and in us being the antlers of the world, right? Because that kind of permanence ceases to be what we're after. We're after something else, and that becomes, again, adornment. If we are not out to conquer the universe, what are we here for? We are here to be awesome. We are here to be the plumage of the world and to make it possible for that kind of plumage to exist in the future as well. And I think that's a fairly sublime, you know, vision of the deep future. If you don't believe in eschatological, final states of enlightenment or transcendence, transhumanist glories of one form or another, and I never have, then what we have is this human capacity to be tremendous. You see this in The Million as well, which is a short novel set in the Lockstep universe, where there's only a million people on the earth, and there's only allowed to be a million people on the earth, and they have inherited all of the wealth and culture and history of humanity. And one of the things they ask of themselves is that they be up to that, that they worthy. Be worthy of that, yeah, both individually and collectively. It's a theme that persists in my work, I guess.
Well, we couldn't help hope for a better statement to wrap up on a big philosophical note. That's great. Thank you.
Well, I think it is it is a transcendent view to think that we are adornment and the plumage of the world. I think that's what an amazing way to think about humanity. Very positive way to think about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Peter would say that, no, more explosions, but he and I will get together for lunch and argue these points.
Yep. That's great.
I don't think we can have a conversation on this show without talking about Peter Watts a little bit. We just love that guy. In fact, the next episode that we have coming out is a conversation we had with Peter Watts and Neil Blomkamp. This is a great conversation. We had a lot of fun with these guys. So join us for that one. It will be out soon. Thank you again. Until next time.